All right, so just want to welcome everybody. We have a distinguished guest today. He's going to talk to us about making new things, the role of industrial ecology in environmental policy and company strategy, but making new things out of, well, rubbish sometimes, I guess.
Sometimes,
yeah. Yeah. That's right. So Professor Roland Clift, by way of introduction, he's a distinguished professor of environmental technology and the founding director of the Center of Environmental Strategy. His research specialization is the broad field of environmental system analysis, life cycle assessment, industrial ecology, and sustainable energy systems. Covers a lot, I would say. He was the head of the Department of Chemical and Process Engineering at the University of Surrey for 10 years. He is a fellow of the Royal Academy of Engineering, of the Institution of Chemical Engineers, and of the Royal Society of Arts, and also an honorary fellow of the Chartered Institute of Waste and Environmental Management. He's a director of the Merrill Lynch New Energy Technologies Investment Trust. He was awarded the Sir Frank Whittle Medal of the Royal Academy of Engineering. He was a member of the Royal Commission on Environmental Pollution and acted as an expert advisor to the inquiry of the House of Lords and Science and Technology in Energy Efficiency. He was appointed a member of the Science Advisory Council of the Department of the Environment, Food and Rural Affairs, and finally, it's a very long list, he's a commander of the British Empire, which he received that honor for his services to the environment. So,
thank you.
Thank you, everybody. Yeah.
So, I think you need this too.
I'm Mark. Okay, thanks. Well, thank you very much for the introduction. I should perhaps also mention that I'm a McGill graduate, actually. I did my PhD at McGill in 1970, and I was a member of the faculty in the chemical engineering department until 1975, when I went back to England. Thank you for the introduction, thank you for the invitation, and also thank you to the British Consulate for helping me to come here. It's always a pleasure to come back to Montreal. I am a chemical engineer by origin, but I've moved into areas which some people regard as being outside chemical engineering. I don't think they are. I think they are a natural extension of chemical engineering. So I'm going to go through some of those, and if you've got the extraordinary benefit of a background in chemical engineering, you'll perhaps be able to see how application of some really very simple chemical engineering thinking to particularly product systems yields some pretty useful insights. Don mentioned, I'm also involved with the International Society for Industrial Ecology. I was the president for a couple of years. I'm currently the executive director. And so I'm going to start by defining what industrial ecology is, and then I'm going to explore a couple of the tools which are widely used in industrial ecology, and then look at some applications, one of which, by the way, will be biofuels. So there you are. If, like me, you castigate your students whenever they quote anything from Wikipedia, I entirely agree with you, except that Wikipedia is the place to look for popular understanding, not for definitions, but for what the people actually understand by a particular term. And here's the Wikipedia entry for industrial ecology. It's actually very accurate. The reason why it's accurate is that it was put there by a bunch of Dutch MSc students who were given the assignment on one of their programs of putting an entry on Wikipedia on industrial ecology. So that's a good definition. So what do you see? It's a systems-based multidisciplinary discourse. It has part of its origins in engineering and systems thinking, but it also draws in other disciplines, including the social sciences and environmental sciences, and some aspects of economics and philosophy. So it's a nice convergence of different disciplinary approaches. The idea of thinking in terms of complex systems is really central to industrial ecology, and the name, which has been much debated, but we're stuck with it, the reason why it's called industrial ecology is that it's one of its genesis, one of its starting points, was asking the question, if human economic systems were modelled on natural ecosystems, what would they look like and what would the benefits be? So, for example, one of the themes in industrial ecology is what's known as industrial symbiosis. How can you organize productive activities so that the waste from one activity becomes a beneficial input to another? So that's the kind of analogy with natural ecosystems which we draw on. If I sum it up a bit more succinctly, again from my chemical engineering background, I'd put it this way. Chemical engineering is about managing flows of materials and energy inside pipes. And industrial ecology is about doing that in the economy. So there's a very direct analogy with the chemical engineering approach. And obviously then, one of the things which we're concerned with in industrial ecology, flows of energy and materials through the economy. So here's a diagram of a general approach which you could call industrial system analysis. So there's the economic system. And in order for that economic system to deliver services, it needs to draw in materials and energy, and it also generates wastes and emissions which may be emitted from the economic system. Maybe. I'll come back to that point in a moment. So a lot of the analysis in industrial ecology is looking at the relationships between the economic system and the surroundings. And the surroundings are the environment. And that, by the way, is the original meaning of the word environment in English. You can date it very precisely. The word environment appeared in English first in the translation from French of the book by Sadi Carnot, which is usually translated into English as Reflections on the Motive Power of Fire. Carnot was interested in the performance of steam engines, and environment came into the language to mean environnement, that which surrounds the system I am interested in. So I'm using environment. Sorry. I'm using environment here in its original sense. Of course, since then, it's acquired all sorts of other connotations. But that's the origin of the word. And by the way, it's about 10 or 15 years younger than the word energy, which only dates from 1805. So we're talking about concepts which have been discussed for 200 years, but not a lot more. Right, so if I'm looking at flows of, I'll start with materials, really, through the economic system. There's the original kind of concept of an industrial economy. So we draw in non-renewable resources, that's materials as well as energy. They're used in agriculture and food production, agrochemicals, fertilizers, and so on. They're also used in processing and manufacturing to generate things which we consume. And when we've consumed them in a linear economy, we regard them as waste. Now, I deliberately draw waste to be within the economic system, because we only lose those materials when they are dissipated into the environment. So, for example, very obvious example, really, you can go back to old landfill sites and excavate them for resources. And that's starting to happen in some parts of the world, Israel and Sweden, for example. The metal content of old landfill sites is actually, in a lot of cases, higher than the metal content of virgin ores, so it becomes a worthwhile activity. Okay, so there's the post-industrial revolution linear economy, but recognizing that waste can be regarded as a resource, then we can ask, what do you do with that waste? Okay, after the consumer has finished with it, you don't need to lose it from the economic system, so can you reuse it in the industrial sector or the agri-food sector? That's the approach which is becoming popular for discussion, at least, known as the circular economy. China has a circular economy law, and if you read it, it's actually about recycling materials within the economy. It doesn't actually go conceptually really very much further than that. There's a lot of debate around the world. For example, the Ellen MacArthur Foundation, set up by the Round the World Yachtswoman, Ellen MacArthur, is talking about how to develop the idea of the circular economy. And that conception is pretty much what I've drawn here. Maintaining material flows within the economy, not losing them as waste. But in industrial ecology, we go one further than that. And I'm going to introduce this concept now because I'm going to develop it a bit further. So far, that diagram looks mainly at the flows between resources, sectors and consumption. But we also ought to include in there the stock. Now, these are economic terms, flows and stocks. So the stock here would represent things like the built environment. The building which we are in is part of the built stock, the built capital, the infrastructure. Transport systems are part of the stock. To use them, you may need flows of energy, fuel, for example, transport fuels. But the stock, nevertheless, needs to be recognized as an important part of the economy. Eric Smith is online on Skype, but I don't think I'll do anything about that. Okay. Right. So another important part of the economic flows is not just to provide the things we consume, but to build up and maintain that stock. And to give you some ideas of what those bits of the industrial ecology diagram represent, non-renewable resources. Well, I asked my PA to come up with some pictures which would illustrate the idea. So non-renewable resources, there's a mining operation, processing and manufacturing, there's a car, assembly line, dispersed emissions, pretty obvious, waste, agri-food sector, consumption, a nice suburban house. But there's the thing that's particularly brilliant, and I thank my PA for this, it wasn't my idea. To represent the built stock, the infrastructure, she represented the Sydney Harbour Opera House and Bridge. Now, if you've been to Sydney, that was a pretty important observation, because the quality of life in Sydney depends to a significant extent on the existence of the Opera House. Even if you don't go there, people in Sydney are terrifically proud of the Opera House, and of course some of the main transport routes go past it, either over the bridge or the ferries, which are one of the main ways of getting around Sydney, go past the Opera House. So I'm going to leave that thought with you and cap'n back on it, that the quality of life depends on the stock as well as the flows. In order to say much more about that, I need to introduce a couple of the tools which are commonplace in industrial ecology. Again, if you're a chemical engineer, these will be pretty obvious to you. They are material flow accounting and life cycle assessment. To start with material flow accounting, what you do in material flow accounting is measure the flows of materials into and out of the economy. And if you do that on a historical time basis, it enables you to estimate the stock of material in the economy. So, for example, I might look at iron and steel, which is something I did some work on a few years ago with a friend who's an economist. So iron and steel come into the economy as raw materials, which may be turned into manufactured goods, or they may be imported, usually in the form of manufactured goods. And then they'll enter various parts of the economy where they make up part of the stock of iron and steel in the economy around us. So stock S1, for example, might be cans, containers for food or beverages. And they have a very short life in the economy. So basically for packaging materials, the flow in equals the flow out. There's very little accumulation of stock in the economy. And I'll come back to the significance of accumulation of stock later. Then there are other uses of iron and steel which have much longer service lives. For example, road vehicles, cars. The average life of a car is, what, 20 or 30 years. Now, here's an interesting observation. You can work out the stock of iron and steel in the economy by looking at the historical data for the flows into the economy with some estimates of the rate at which it leaves at the end of the service life. After service life, the waste material might be reused, or it might be recycled, and I'll come back to the difference between those, or it might be exported. Scrap iron and steel these days mainly goes to China, where the stock is being built up. If you don't actually do any of those things with it, it becomes waste, so it goes into that stock on the previous diagram, and it may be eventually lost from the economy. So the different applications of, in this case, iron and steel, have different service lives, residence times, if you're a chemical engineer. Residence time theory applies here, actually. So if you've got a reasonable estimate for the residence time, the service life of any of those stocks, you know how far you've got to go back in the time series to build up a picture of the stock of material in the economy. This has become a big activity, and there's some particularly comprehensive work done at Yale University on the accumulation of key materials in the economy. They're working their way through the periodic table, actually, and that's part of the input to the United Nations Environment Programme on resource efficiency. Okay, so if you look at, take one of those, for example, cars. Interestingly, when you do that analysis, you find that the stock of iron and steel in the economy, in a developed industrial economy, that is, Britain or Canada, the stock of material in the economy changes remarkably little over time. The reason is that cars get lighter, but there are more of them on the roads. So it turns out that the two roughly compensate. So I'm introducing a simplification, which I'll come back to, that in a lot of cases, in a developed economy, which has stabilized in its use of materials, those stocks turn out to be reasonably constant over time, which is a very useful simplification to be able to make. Okay, so that's material flow accounting. It's basically no more than material balances, but going back to my definition of industrial ecology, it's applied to the economy rather than to a processing operation. The other tool, which is absolutely central to industrial ecology, is life cycle assessment. And in life cycle assessment, you look at the complete supply chain leading up to the delivery of, ideally, a service, and you try to estimate at each of the stages in the supply chain what the principal inputs and emissions are, those exchanges between the environment and the economic system. So whereas in material flow accounting, your system boundary was a country or an economic sector, in life cycle assessment, your system boundary is drawn around a supply chain. Right, now recognizing where I am, let me say something about biofuels. If you're looking at turning a crop into a biofuel, which is used to power, for example, a road vehicle, then on the face of it, you would say this is beneficial because it displaces the use of non-renewable fossil fuels and replaces them by use of a resource which comes from organic origins. Well, you have to be rather careful about that. Let me tell you with absolute certainty, because I was told this by one of the scientific advisors who was around at the time, in Europe, the biofuels directive, which is a mandated level of biological material in transport fuels, the biofuels directive was brought in without anyone thinking to ask what the life cycle looked like. The assumption was, this is an organic material, therefore we'll just grow it, it's renewable, so let's have a lot of it. This thinking was not there. And the realization, frankly, that the European Commission got it wrong is implicit in a lot of the stuff which has been coming out from various directorates in Brussels in the last couple of years. So let me explain why you need to look very carefully at the life cycle when you're looking at the use of biofuels. Well, where did the biofuel come from? I've drawn it here as, again, because I'm in Canada, as coming from wheat. So I kind of mix things on this diagram. Okay, I'm over-egging it perhaps, but this is to make the point. If you're going to get a biofuel from a crop, then for a start, that biofuel has to be processed into ethanol, biodiesel, whatever it might be. That operation produces co-products, and you need to account for them in the analysis. The processing uses energy. So already you see that you've got to look at the balance between the energy yield delivered by that biological fuel and the energy which is input to agricultural production and processing. And that's what's called the attributional approach. You simply look at the supply chain and do these balances. And if you do that, you find that even bioethanol may actually not be a benefit in terms of greenhouse gas emissions. The arch example is, I think, probably Thailand, where they've got a program to include biodiesel in gasoline. If you pull into a filling station in Bangkok, you fill up your car with gasoline containing some bioethanol. Thailand has a very carbon-intensive energy system, mainly powered by coal. So if you do the life cycle assessment for Thailand, you find that using bioethanol actually increases greenhouse gas emissions because of the emissions associated with these energy flows. That's not the whole story, because if you are serious about producing energy crops, you've got to ask the question, okay, where are you going to grow them? Famous quotation by Mark Twain, I think it was. Buy land, they don't make it anymore. Now, another part of the European Biofuels Directive, which was another question that was not asked, not even thought of at the time the directive was brought in. Okay, where are we going to grow all this biodiesel and bioethanol? And if you do the sums, you would need to convert something like two-thirds of the agricultural land in Europe, 65%, from food production to energy crops to meet the European Biofuels Directive. Now, of course, people aren't going to cut down their dietary intake by a third just so that you can grow biodiesel or bioethanol. So that knocks on to land use changes in other parts of the world. One of the big criticisms, for example, about biodiesel, is that demand for biodiesel means oil crops being grown somewhere else. And the one which has been particularly highlighted is production of palm oil in particularly Malaysia and Indonesia. And that's why the drive towards biodiesel in Europe has been picked up by some of the environmental NGOs. The companies who produce palm oil for food, understandably, got quite irate about that. And as a result, the roundtable on sustainable palm oil was set up to try and answer questions like, how do we avoid deforestation in order to plant palm oil plantations to deliver the oil, which is going to go not into the diet, but into fuels. And of course, habitat loss in Indonesia and Malaysia is, to name another iconic species, one of the reasons for the decline in population of the orangutan. So that's what's known as consequential life cycle analysis, or life cycle assessment. From there on, you simply describe the supply chain. That's attributional analysis. But if you want to get a full picture of the effect of using that biofuel, you've got to ask, what effects does it have outside the immediate system? And one of the effects is land use change. And land use change is a very hot topic. It will be mentioned in probably quite some length in the report of the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is due out later this year. And how you deal with land use change is going to be a major issue in that IPCC report. I flag that as something you might want to look at. So, what you've got to be careful about, it seems to me, when you're advocating things like biofuels, please, please, please do the life cycle assessment first. Because I run into a lot of work on second and third generation biofuels, which turns out to be clever ways of doing something stupid. So you've really got to ask the question first, should I be doing this at all? To develop that one a bit further, thermodynamic supplies even to microorganisms. So I do occasionally have to remind people of that. So let's look at what the alternatives are for using biomass. So, for example, where I live, I do quite a lot of work on wood fuel. As it happens, Surrey, which is not very far from London, is the county in England which has the largest proportion of woodland. A lot of it is unmanaged, so there's a lot of biomass lying around in local woodland, which is increasingly being used as an energy source. In fact, my university, after a lot of effort to persuade them, have put in a biomass heating unit for its Olympic swimming pool, and that was a significant step forward. So, there's the biomass. In that case, in the form of wood, it might be straw from wheat cultivation and so on. Okay, you tend to think of it as a waste material. But if it really is a waste material, what's the best thing to do with it? Well, you might just burn it in a heating or a combined heat and power plant, in which case it goes to the combustion products and you get the energy release, which is the calorific value of the fuel. Now, if you want to do something clever with it, and turn it into something like a high-specification biofuel, a number of things are different. First off, you've got to process that biomass. And whereas you can do simple combustion on a small scale, processing that biomass into a transport fuel usually requires a large capital-intensive operation, which means you have to transport it further. The usual rule of thumb with biomass wood or straw or whatever, don't ship it more than 25 kilometres. Because if you do, the energy consumption in transport starts to eat in very heavily to the transport yield. So you want to keep the processing or use plants quite small. Small CHP plants are good, but if you ship it a large distance, you've already used some energy there. You now do your clever processing to turn it into a refined product, which will require more energy input. And then the second law kicks in, and there are bound to be some thermodynamic losses. So by the time you've got over here, and there's your refined product, the transport fuel, the energy which is available for release when you burn that is always going to be smaller than the energy which you would have obtained if you'd simply burnt it in the first place. How much smaller? Well, I have yet to see even a hypothetical system like that which achieves more than 50% of the energy available here. Most of them are very much lower. So that's my next conclusion. Even if you do it on an attributional basis and don't allow for what's called consequential land use change, even if you do the analysis on an attributional basis, you've got to ask very carefully, is it worth turning that biomass into the refined product? Now, the industry, of course, which is most enthusiastic about this is the aviation sector, because basically jet engines take kerosene. They're optimized for kerosene. And if you work out how much land would need to be given over to producing kerosene to support the aviation industry, you come to the conclusion there ain't enough. The aviation industry is now looking at things like algae as sources of kerosene for jet fuel. Whether that will be viable remains to be seen. I'm hugely skeptical because of the capital investments involved. Okay, so what I'm basically saying here is look very carefully at what you're doing, because it may not be the optimal thing to do. And in most cases that I've looked at, if you're just going to use the biomass as an energy source, you might as well just burn it, in which case that means what the world needs is not clever ways of turning it into transport fuels, but small-scale, reliable, combined heat and power plants. And if anybody can come up with a small-scale, reliable, small-scale, a few megawatts, combined heat and power plant, I think the world's their oyster. Huge demand for it in, for example, sub-Saharan Africa. So if you are going to transform that biomass into a refined product, I think it doesn't actually make a lot of sense to turn it into a liquid, all this effort to turn it into a liquid which is not much more expensive than drinking water. And if you are going to turn it into a refined product, make it something of high value. And then you're still left with the residue, which you can use as a fuel. Okay, so what I'm basically saying here is, if you're in the business of producing biofuels, stop and think. Always start with the life cycle assessment. Okay, now let me move on to something else. Industrial ecology is about trying to model the industrial system on natural ecosystems in a way which can be more efficient. And what we're trying to achieve is known as decoupling. So the idea is that GDP, economic activity, increases over time. The economic system is set up on the assumption that GDP will increase at a few percent per year, and when it doesn't, we get very twitchy about it. Now, that's an assumption which has been questioned. For example, Peter Victor in Ontario has written a rather influential book called Management Without Growth, and one of my colleagues at Surrey, Tim Jackson, has written a book called Prosperity Without Growth. The two of them actually work together. And this has opened up what I think is a very important debate. What would an economy look like if it wasn't predicated on economic growth? So I'm going to park that argument. It's important, but I don't have time to go into it. So I'm going to continue with the assumption usually made that GDP will go up over time, but the carrying capacity and the resource availability of the planet will not go up over time. So how can we separate the two? Well, you can certainly achieve relative decoupling, which means that the environmental pressures don't go up as fast as economic activity. But ideally, we want to achieve absolute decoupling, which is, if your economy is going to grow, can it grow, and at the same time, the environmental pressures reduce? Well, here's an example. These are the figures for the Netherlands, simply because I have them. There's nothing particularly special about the Netherlands. Since 1985, GDP has gone up. I've only got the figures to the early 2000s. But you can see typical growth in GDP over time. And many of the environmental pressures associated with economic activities in the Netherlands have indeed gone down. So that's waste management, eutrophication, acidification, land disturbance. Land disturbance is fairly flat. The Dutch, of course, are very bothered about land disturbance because it's a small country with a high population density. But the one I'll perhaps focus on is the blue one, the climate, contribution to climate change. So in the Netherlands, the GDP has gone up, but the total emissions from the Dutch economy of climate-changing gases have stayed pretty well flat. So they've, on the face of it, achieved decoupling. GDP has gone up, environmental pressure hasn't. Actually, this conceals something very important. This is the climate change emissions from the economic activities in the Netherlands. But if you look at consumption in the Netherlands, you get a very different picture. So what you do is account for the emissions of greenhouse gases from producing goods and materials which are produced elsewhere and imported and consumed in the Netherlands. So the distinction there is between production accounting, emissions from the activities in the country, and consumption accounting, which is associated with consumption in the country. Now, some of the best work on this has been done by the Industrial Ecology Group at Trondheim, the Norwegian Technical University in Trondheim. They were, I think, the first to hit on this. And it struck home because the Norwegians like to pride themselves on being environmentally responsible. And indeed, when you look at the domestic activities in Norway, you find that they have apparently achieved decoupling. When you look at consumption, you get a very different picture because of the environmental pressures embodied in the stuff which is imported into Norway. So I think Norway was the country where this first became a public issue. It's now become recognized much more widely, and the problem is known as carbon leakage. You see, what happened in the European industrialized countries is that the most polluting industries were exported. Okay, so when you do your accounting on a domestic basis, you appear to have achieved decoupling, but when you look at the consumption basis, you get a very different picture. And Scandinavian countries who like to pride themselves don't show up so well when you allow for imports. Okay, now, there is now then an argument about how international accounts of particularly greenhouse gases should be drawn up. Should they be done on a production basis or a consumption basis? That's not an easy question, by the way. There are various reasons which I won't have time to go to in detail. One of the arguments is, well, the country which is producing the stuff which is imported into, say, Norway, gets the economic benefit of that activity, so we really ought to account we ought to stick with the production basis rather than the consumption basis. This is an ongoing debate. Body which had been set up in the UK, for example, the Committee on Climate Change, is looking at the moment on this distinction between production and consumption accounting. But here's a different light on it. And this goes back to some work I did 15 years ago now with Nokia, the telephone company. Nokia asked me and one of my doctoral students to look at the question, why is it that a used mobile phone, there you are, there's a Nokia mobile phone, I still use one of those, used mobile phone appears to be less valuable than raw ore in the ground. It's uneconomic to recycle or re-engineer a mobile telephone. Now, the fact that it's uneconomic is obvious. In Europe, Canada, elsewhere, we've gone a long way in the direction of take-back legislation, which requires producers to take products back at the end of their service life. If it was economic to recover and recycle things, it would happen without that legislation. Okay? So the fact that we need the legislation is evidence of this economic perversity. So we looked at that, and what we did was to break the supply chain for the mobile telephone down into its essential stages. So that one is mining, two is refining, three is manufacturing, turning the materials into the components of product, four is distribution and retail. On that axis, you've got a measure of environmental impact. On that axis, you've got the added value of each operation. That's the contribution of that operation to the economy in which it's located. This is a schematic. The actual figures are in a paper which is published 13 years ago now. So what does this tell you? There you've got an extraordinary shape describing the balance of environmental impacts and economic value along the supply chain. And what it tells you is that mining is an activity which is associated with big environmental impacts and not much economic benefit. I leave that with you in Quebec to think about that one. What this says to me is that if you're looking for economic development, what you want to do is get to that end of the supply chain, because that's where the economic value is and where the environmental benefit is low. So bring this back to what I was saying about the Netherlands. GDP in the Netherlands has gone up. Environmental impacts have stayed steady or gone down. And the reason is that the low value, high impacting industries have gone elsewhere. I'm not specifically targeting the Netherlands. This is a general observation. So the answer to the question raised by Nokia, why is it uneconomic to recycle a mobile telephone, is summed up by that curve. Okay? So if I take that point A, which represents the actual mobile telephone, get to the end of its service life, and try to turn it back into a new telephone, well, I have to collect it up, I have to re-engineer it and redistribute it, and I end up with a point which is certainly much lower in terms of environmental impacts, but costs a lot more. That point B, drawn to scale, is over there somewhere. So what this tells me is that the reason for this apparently perverse economics is actually the fact that we undervalue the primary resource. That's starting to correct itself in some places because some of the key metals for devices like mobile telephones are actually going up in price. That's good, actually, from my point of view. That acts as an incentive towards recovery and recycling. Now, that graph was first drawn up for, as I said, mobile telephones, but it turns out to be remarkably general. And here's some work which is done by a Norwegian student who came to the University of Surrey for a while, where we looked at the garment sector. And those two curves there, well, you see they show that characteristic convex shape, and they refer to T-shirts, okay, cheap T-shirts. So, unsurprisingly, the retailer gets the economic benefit but can claim to be environmentally responsible. And the environmental hit, and not much economic value, occurs in the early part of the supply chain, the growing the cotton, weaving it, stitching the T-shirt, and so on. So, unsurprisingly perhaps, that's what the curve looks like for cheap clothing. Now you overlay on that the social benefits. Who gets the social benefits of producing these garments? Well, we've seen that in the last couple of weeks, that horrific collapse of a garment factory in Bangladesh is an example. Okay, this low economic value associated with high environmental impact is also associated with low social benefit and bad working conditions. And it gets slightly worse than that for reasons which I'll come on to. But let me now point out, the shaded area on that diagram is the range of different garment supply chains. Okay? Some of them are very convex. Those are the cheap, sweatshop, low-life, short-life garments. Some of them are down here, a bit concave or straight. And the garments which are down here turn out to be the luxury garments. Okay? This is stuff which is produced for higher-end labels, maybe even fashion houses, where there's a high labour input, therefore actually rather less environmental impact per pound or dollar spent, and it's a more skilled labour input, so the wage levels are higher. Okay? So what this diagram actually highlights is a difference between high quality, high labour content garments and cheap chuckaway T-shirts. Okay, I'm arguing in favour of quality, and let me now pursue that. The move towards cheap, short-life garments, T-shirts, shirts, whatever, has accelerated in the last few years. So in the UK, over the last 5 years, the quantity of textile in the municipal waste stream has more than doubled. It's known officially as the Primark effect. Primark is a chain of retailers that sell very cheap clothing. I don't go in the door. But the Primark effect has led to people buying clothes which they're going to wear a few times, then they get bored with them and throw them away. That leads to the kind of activity which we saw in Bangladesh a couple of weeks ago. Cost pressures to provide that very cheap stuff mean that the convex supply chains are favoured. And it has the problem at home that it increases the amount of textile in the waste stream. Okay. Now go back to the stocks model. What would you do if you wanted to reduce the amount of textile in the municipal waste stream? Well, the stock of clothes that people hold doesn't change much over time, limited by their closet space. So if people can keep their clothes in use for longer, that reduces the amount of textile in the waste stream, and it also favours the supply chains which are down towards the lower end of that diagram, where there's a high and skilled labour content. So for me, this argues, everything converges on the thought that if I buy a shirt or a suit or whatever, I shouldn't buy it in Primark, I should buy it in an expensive shop, but I keep it for longer, so it doesn't actually cost me more. Okay? Now, it may not look like it, but this is actually a fairly expensive handmade suit, and the reason it may not look like it is that I've had it for 5 or 6 years and worn it a lot. Okay? Well, that's fine. That's putting my money where my mouth is on the basis of this analysis. Okay, so now let's pursue that one a bit further. So my conclusion is that when you buy clothes, you should buy quality and expect to keep the clothes for a long time. By the way, the fashion industry has caught on to this one, and there are schemes starting to become available where you might buy something expensive, and then when you've got tired of it, you don't put it in the waste stream, you take it back, and then it's cleaned up and sold on. It's like the thrift store, charity shop idea, but it's actually moved up the market a bit so you can buy quality clothing which has already been used by somebody else. One of the UK companies, Marks & Spencer, introduced this and called it swapping. It's an interesting idea and one which is certainly to be encouraged. Right. Now let's apply that more generally. So I might apply this to clothing. I might apply it to appliances or cars. And as I pointed out to you earlier on, the stock of material in use in the economy in a lot of cases turns out to not to change much over time. So rather than focusing on the flows, let's now focus on the stock. Okay? So there's the stock of clothes in your closet or cars on the road. What flows do we need to maintain that stock? Well, there'll be a flow of new goods into use. There'll be a flow of used goods out of use. So start there, Q. Of that material which comes out of use, some of it could be reused. Okay? That's components of an appliance, components of a car. It might be clothing under the swapping scheme. I've done this in terms of energy inputs, but you could do it in other terms. You could turn the arrows around and look at waste generation. Same applies. So there'll be a certain amount of energy which is needed to reuse part of that waste. If you recycle it, that means reprocessing. So the energy use per unit of material or product will be higher. E2, which is the energy input for recycling, will be larger than E1, usually. That's the energy input for reuse. And in order to provide that flow of goods into use, the balance, not provided by reuse and cycling, the balance will be provided by primary material. And the energy to produce the primary material, E3, is usually very much larger than E2, which in turn is larger than E1. Right, well, if you're a chemical engineer, what's the big deal? It's a simple flow sheet. Well, it is a very simple idea, but it's remarkable how few people have cottoned on to this. Okay, so I now ask, what is the total energy requirement, not to maintain the flows, but to maintain the stock? Okay, so I'm starting from that stock S. So, what can we say? Well, the input, P, goods going into use, is equal to the waste outflow plus the change in stock over time. Well, the change in stock over time may not be very large. And it may even be negative, actually, in a few cases. So if I can go with that assumption and simply say S is constant, then P and Q are equal, and I've got some really rather useful conclusions I can draw. So the energy consumption needed to maintain that stock depends on the energy use per unit for reuse, recycling, primary material, times the total flow. So if your objective is to try to reduce energy consumption in the economy, actually the place to start is there. These individual terms are already pretty low. I mean, the pressures have been on industrial activities forever to improve their energy efficiency. So E1, E2, and E3 have already been driven down. So the scope for reducing energy use starts mainly by reducing P. And when you've done as much as you can to reduce P, you then look at increasing the proportion reused and recycled, which is probably fairly obvious. It's the P bit which is usually missed. So what that tells me is that to reduce the energy intensity of the economy, the best thing we can do is extend service life. I gave you an example of that from clothing, and it applies to other things as well. Because, if you're a chemical engineer, you will recognise that the through flow, P, is equal to the stock divided by the service life, residence time. Okay? Now, that's not the way we operate at the moment. But this is an idea which has been advocated by a number of people. One of my heroes is a man by the name of Walter Stahl, who was in Geneva. He's a sort of one-man think tank funded by the Swiss insurance industry. Walter has been pointing this out for a long time. It's the move beyond what he calls, what we've called the closed-loop economy, to what he calls the performance economy. And what he basically says is, substitute labour for energy. So rather than making new goods, have people re-engineer them. Okay? And if you're in an economy like we all are, where employment is a scarce resource, then this is actually, it has its own attraction, because it's making the economy less energy intensive and more labour intensive, in other words, creating more employment. Okay, so now, if I follow Walter Stahl and look at the performance economy, concentrate on maintaining the stock, extending service life, rather than concentrating on the energy efficiency of individual operations. And I've given you an example. Clothing is an example where reducing the environmental impact and also extending the social benefits up the supply chain depend on having longer life quality goods. Right, now let's relate this to quality of life. And this is a diagram which is fairly famous in Europe, and I know some people in Canada at least have come across it. And this is some work done by Layard at the London School of Economics, where he's tried to relate happiness to per capita disposable income. Now, obviously, measuring happiness is a pretty difficult thing. You can ask people how happy they feel, and it's a bit subjective. There are other measures. You can look at measures of public health, life expectancy. They may introduce differences between countries, but the general shape of the diagram stays the same, however you measure quality of life, which is what's on that axis. So what you see is that up to a per capita income of about $15,000, disposable income, there is a correlation between quality of life and disposable income. Once you get above about $15,000, you find that there's actually no strong correlation. And I put some red dots on there to help. So that one is Canada. Okay, that one is Britain. And just for comparison, that one is China. Now, China is a slightly difficult case because it's really two intercalated societies. But you see on these scales, and however you measure this parameter, Britain and Canada turn out to be about the same in terms of quality of life. Most of them, by the way, show the quality of life in both countries as being considerably higher than in the United States. And life expectancy, if I remember rightly, in Canada is more than 2 years longer than it is in the US. So that's part of the measure. But when you get out here, you find that there's actually not much correlation between quality of life and per capita income. What you always find is that the Nordic countries turn out to be the top of the heap. This was Iceland before the financial collapse, by the way, but it's coming back. The Nordic countries always turn out to be highest in terms of quality of life. I have to say, subjectively, I think that's right. I spend a lot of my time in Sweden, and the reason I do that is that I like it socially. It's not the weather. I like Swedish society. It's a comfortable country to live in. So there's another level of analysis, and I'm a big fan of work by Wilkinson in the UK, who said, okay, when you get into this area out here, if there's no strong correlation with per capita disposable income, what does it correlate with? And one of Wilkinson's answers, his principal answer actually, is that there is a very strong negative correlation with disparity of income. So the countries which have the highest measured quality of life are the countries in which there's least disparity between the richest and poorest. In other words, the Nordic countries. This is why they turn up top of the heap. And it goes down to another level. If you look at the difference between states in the USA, Wilkinson also finds that correlation. The states which have the lowest disparity of income are the ones with the highest reported quality of life. So, once you're above that threshold, critical level, the empirical evidence says that there is not much correlation, if any, between quality of life and disposable income. Well, if I now link this to Walter Stahl's ideas on the performance economy. Go back to that diagram. Okay, so here we are as consumers. What determines our quality of life? Well, it's not really strongly correlated with disposable income, but what I think, following on from Walter's observations and my PA's brilliant idea of representing that by the Sydney Opera House, it depends much more on the stock than on the flows. Well, you could go one stronger than that. If you have bad building stock, for example, UK has some of the worst buildings in the world in terms of energy efficiency. In order to maintain quality of life, internal temperature, you need to spend a lot. So there's a negative correlation, actually, between money spent on heating your home and quality of life. So what this leads me to is the conclusion that if we try to focus all the time on flows, like disposable income, we're missing the point. What actually matters is the quality of the stock which characterizes the society in which we live. And that leads into another debate, which I'm not going to go into here, but which we started over the last couple of days in a conference at CIREG. You then look at the five capitals model, and it starts to tell you quite useful things about this. Look at that. Let's relate this to consumer expenditure. Here's some work that was done by a couple of my colleagues at the University of Surrey who looked at the environmental impacts of consumer expenditure by households in the UK. So this is the average household expenditure. And what's plotted in the pie chart is the contribution of that form of consumer spending to, in this case, climate change. And by the way, the single biggest component there, recreation and leisure, that might be surprising, but I'll tell you the reason for that is that air travel is included. Air travel is by far the most environmentally damaging thing we do. If you back out air travel, the rest of it makes sense. So the various forms of household expenditure all contribute broadly the same sort of level to the environmental footprint of the household. Clothing, I've already said a bit about. Food and catering is in there. Household expenditure, space heating. Space heating is particularly a large component in the UK because of the bad building stock. In each of those categories, well-being, with the possible exception of food and catering, Well-being is determined by the stock, not by the flow. So clothing and footwear, for example, I've already advocated quality, long-life goods, which will have a lower environmental footprint and actually make you feel better and over time not cost more. So, with the possible exception of food and catering, I'm all for spending money on food and beverages. I think life is far too short to drink more whiskey, for example. But all the other categories, it's the stock, not the flow, that matters. Right, this is work in progress. Industrial ecology is where I've got to, at least in my thinking. But where this gets me to is, look at the social impacts along the supply chain. So if I buy something, a suit, for example, I want to know where it came from and what the working conditions were for the people who made it. And I hope that has become clear to the population generally. If there's a good result from that horrible event in Bangladesh, it will be that people will pay more attention to social conditions in the supply chains. And you can come up with a list of things that you might attend to, and there's an activity on trying to apply life cycle assessment to assessing social impacts. But the sort of headline conclusion that gets me to is this one. It's a redefinition of quality. So if I'm spending my money, and I want to spend it in a responsible way, I'm going to spend it on something which will last a long time, will therefore have a lower environmental impact per pound, and will, I hope, provide social benefits to the people in the supply chain. So that's a redefinition of quality. It's already embodied in the fair trade principle, which has been set up to try to ensure that supply chains provide more benefit to those people in the first bit of the supply chain. You remember, small added value, high environmental impact. It's an attempt to straighten out that supply chain curve. So here we are, back to my original diagram. That picture, by the way, I put in not just to show you that I like nice hats, but that's taken on a beach in the extreme southwest of Portugal, a village called Sagres, which is interesting because it's the place where the modern world began. You wouldn't necessarily know that if you went there, but the reason I say that is this is where, in the 15th century, Prince Henry the Navigator set up the navigation school, which started the voyages of discovery, which led the Portuguese to trade with Brazil for probably 20 years before Columbus officially discovered America. And they went all the way to the Far East and were the first Europeans to trade in bulk commodities with China, Japan, India, Ceylon. So the fact that we have that globalized trade system, thanks to the Portuguese in the 15th century, is the reason why we have to wrestle with these sorts of concerns. We're looking at globalized supply chains. So is it necessarily the case that my consumption should bring anything other than benefit to the people who work to enable me to consume things? So this tells me that Gucci is good for the earth because Gucci is high expensive, durable clothing, and a lot of the labour is done in skilled workshops, not just in France, but in Mauritius, for example, which has a large garment industry, but it's the high-value end of the industry. So Gucci is good for the earth. Angels wear Prada, contrary to what you will have been told elsewhere. So where does the devil go? Well, the devil shops at IKEA. And my Swedish friends don't like me saying that one, but there is a reason why I say it. IKEA may manage their supply chains, but their business model is wrong because they've turned what should be durable luxury purchases into commodities. So there you are. I've taken you from some fairly mechanistic applications of industrial ecology thinking deriving from chemical engineering. I've tried to bring in other social and economic considerations and ended up with some conclusions which I think are actually interesting if you're concerned with the way the human economy needs to develop to reach that mythical goal of sustainability. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for an extremely thought-provoking presentation. Mm-hmm. And we have time for questions, discussion, no fighting, but everything else. Anybody? Questions? There's lots to think about there. Don't be shy. No? Well, okay, I'll start. So my thinking, we were talking about biofuels, so you know, I'm a bit tied to that right now.
Yeah.
So I've been thinking for a long time to get this issue about fluid fuels versus solid fuels, because I have engineer colleagues who want more than they really want to make fluid fuels out of whatever, right? But my own contention when I talk to them about it is, you know, if we don't need to make the fluid fuels, we shouldn't, because we lose so much of the energy during the processing. Yeah. And so I've been discussing things like Stirling engines and things like this that can burn solid fuels and things.
Yeah.
And I'm guessing what you're saying is this would be the way to go in the long
run. Absolutely.
But
yes.
The issue for the airline industry, I think, still sits there because I don't know.
What the future of the airline industry is an interesting corollary. I mean, it seems to me absolutely clear that the last barrel of crude oil will be burnt in an aircraft engine.
Okay, exactly. Yeah. And for those of you who don't know, a Stirling engine is an engine that can burn solid fuel, but it's a piston engine. It's an interesting concept. And I think the American Motors Company actually built a Stirling engine prototype in the 70s.
Yes.
So
they're being looked at for stationary CHP plants, unsurprisingly. Yeah.
Okay. I've tried. Somebody else? Go ahead. And he's going to run with the microphone here, so, yeah.
I really enjoyed your talk. My question is, this seems to be top down. If you have the money, you can spend it, and therefore facilitate good practices.
Yes.
What about for everybody else? So most people can't afford Prada and Gucci. Or handmade suits, which I would love to have as a student.
Yeah. You're right that I'm looking at it from the point of view of people like me and you. Frankly, you're about 15,000, I bet, even if you're a student, dollars per year. But what follows from this is part of the question is, okay, given that my starting point is I and other people are going to spend their disposable income. Very few of us are so marvellously generous that we're going to give away what we don't absolutely need. So part of what's behind my question there is, how can I spend that money in a way which causes least environmental impact and confers most social benefit to the players in the supply chain? So that's where I get to the conclusion that you and I ought to spend our money on luxury goods. It's perfectly okay to eat chocolate, provided you get expensive, good quality chocolate with a fair trade label on it. It's perfectly okay to wear clothes, provided you get them from a supply chain which has a high labour content, preferably skilled labour, with decent wage levels, so that some of my expenditure brings benefit to the people who are back up the supply chain. And by the way, I want to wear it longer, because that's how I reduce the environmental impact. Okay, so it's top down in a way, but it's also got some messages in it for personal behavior.
Okay, oh, here we go. Hang on.
Thank you very much. Very interesting talk. Two questions, actually. They're very short, I think.
Yeah.
How does your vision of things compare to ecological economics, number one? Mm-hmm. And then number two, you talked about the biofuel as an alternative resource. What about some of the other renewable resources, and how do you factor them into the equation?
I think where I've got to converge is on ecological economics. To the extent that I'm into the ecological economics literature, I don't think there's actually any tension there. Other renewable sources of energy, I've looked at it most, obviously, for the UK, and I've done quite a lot of work on energy scenarios. And you can't say that there is an energy source which will solve all the problems. You need all the sources of energy available. So what I've been talking about here is how to use biomass, but we still need wind, hydro, the rest of them. No, it's not an exclusive answer. However, it's potentially a bigger answer than a lot of people realize. And the interesting case is Austria. Some of the provinces of Austria, biomass, wood, usually Salix actually, provides something like 15% of the primary energy. And those are the only cases I know of which have managed to achieve absolute decoupling, even on a consumption basis. You know, they decarbonized by using locally grown biomass as one of the principal, and they're too clever to try to turn it into transport fuels.
Okay, there's somebody else over here. Oh, Annie, can you...
Well, thank you for your very interesting presentation. It's interesting for me. I'm a molecular biologist, so I'm out of your field, but I found it very interesting. So my question is regarding your last conclusion. You said people must wear expensive things, and but my question is, we know that the emerging countries, the middle class in the emerging countries, has as model the Western models.
Yeah. You know,
riding the big SUVs, go to McDonald's, and so how do we convince those people to adopt the same behavior?
You're right that that's an imperative. And I think the fashion industry is potentially one to start with. Okay? And this idea of longevity is starting to penetrate. The fashion industry realize that they have got an environmental and social footprint. So I think that's probably the way into people's hearts and minds. And the reason why I like the conclusion, I mean, a lot of people when I first present this say, hang on, you're telling me that a sustainable lifestyle involves buying luxury goods. Well, number one, yes, I think it is. And number two, actually, that's a much better message than telling people you ought to go around in sandals and worn-out socks. Yeah, so that's, I think, the place to start.
Go ahead. Yeah, thank you very much for a nice talk. And my question is, if we could think about like cellulose and biomass to convert it into bioethanol, or we can we do this like we can increase the amount of cellulose in the crops? Maybe we can use the waste of crops so that there might not be competition in food, and that like we can say the wheat straw and even the grasses. If we can increase the cellulose amount in these things, like can we use for biofuel, or we can think about it like it's our necessity now, we have to go somewhere for that. Can we do it?
Well, if you go back to that, I won't try and find it now. That diagram where I compared first law comparison of pathways. You've got to have a pretty efficient way of turning cellulose into something else before it competes with just using the cellulose as a fuel. Add to that the fact that you're usually going to need large centralized processing facilities, which adds the transport component. So I'd perhaps turn it round, say, can you tell me how you could process cellulose in a way which would overall be more beneficial than just burning it?
I think maybe we can identify the genes which are responsible for cellulose.
Yeah.
And we can introduce those genes in...
Well, in that case, I would say you've got to start from the life cycle assessment to tell you how efficient your cellulose processing would need to be in order to be advantageous. Maybe you can find a way of doing it, but I haven't seen one yet.
So what do you suggest?
So it sets the target for you.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, this is an extra target, actually. Yeah.
But it's a useful... I think it's a necessary way of thinking about it.
Yeah, but we have to.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you.
And by the way, if you do the assessment, one of the very few cases where there is potential benefit in biofuels that I've seen is sugarcane grown on Cerrado land in Brazil, because there's not that much effect of land use change. And there you get a carbon payback period of the order of a few years. Okay. Carbon payback is the time you need to use the biofuel to compensate for the carbon releases due to the land use change. Ethanol from Brazil may be a possibility, but if you start looking at things like wet rainforest turned into palm oil for biodiesel, the energy payback time goes up into the hundreds of years.
Yeah.
So the energy payback time is a good way of looking at it.
Yeah. Thank you.
Anybody else? Oh, there we go. Hang on. Oh, and he's got it. Okay.
Recently in Canada, we came to know that our political decisions, like our supposedly political decisions, were being dictated by the energy industry. You know?
Yeah.
And I think what the young woman said was sort of relevant in that we're all motivated in our labor right now to, you know, buy profit,
yeah.
Right? Within sort of infrastructures that are not flexible.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
Could you speak to that?
You know more about the situation in Canada than I do. But it seems to me that the way energy policy, energy supply in Canada has gone is perverse. I could put it more strongly than that, but perverse will be the way I'd put it. And I, you know, I'm all in favour of not building the pipelines in the West, actually. So it's locking the Canadian energy economy into a system which is absolutely not sustainable. And that's before you get into the First Nations rights issues. I hesitate to criticise the political system in a country where I don't live. That's why I'm not saying any more.
Okay. Anybody else? Are we done? All right. Well, thank you, everybody, for coming. And thank you again to Dr. Cliff
thank
for really an interesting talk and an interesting discussion. All right. If anybody has any questions, you want to talk to Dr. Cliff directly, we'll hold him here for a few minutes.
Yes, fine.
Okay. Take care. Thanks.